Blog Talk Radio.
When puppets fall, it may prove too early to predict the fall of Egypt's president for life, Hosni Mubarak. But events do not look hopeful for long-term success. Mubarak's regime has been the cornerstone of U.S. Middle East strategy. For as an Arab state, it boasts the biggest population, and as Egypt goes, so goes the region. Mubarak, who succeeded to power after the army's assassination of President Anwar el-Sadat on October 6, 1981, stood by Sadat's peace deal with Israel and has been more an ally of the West than of the Palestinians and other Arab nationalities. For his services, Egypt has been one of the biggest recipients of U.S. military aid in the region, second to Israel, of course. Despite his long services to his Western paymasters, Mubarak is being prepared for an unwilling retirement. Mubarak, a man long on Egyptian internal security, may have been undone by kids of the Twitter generation. For those devoted to this technology, protests could be staged across the country against the regime. Egypt's president may be on a rowboat, largely because of the nation's economic crisis, its gnawing unemployment problems, and the brutal, fiendish nature of the police. For several months now, pictures of people beaten and abused by cops have been flashed across the country via the internet. But as in Tunisia, brutality and repression by police can only work for so long. Once fear evaporates, resistance grows. Egypt has served as the export destination of those who suffered U.S. rendition, whom the U.S. wanted to disappear forever. And now, after decades of acquiescence to U.S. imperial whims, Mubarak may receive the Shah treatment, exile, if not worse. Panama's former dictator, General Omar Torrijos, who gave brief refuge to an ailing Shah of Iran, remarked upon receiving his guest, "This is what happens to a man squeezed by the great nations," said Torrijos. "After all the juice is gone, they throw him away." From death row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That was Mumia Abu Jamal. And I am, without a doubt, I am solo, and this is Your World News. And I am joined on air right now with my comrade, Peter Fowler, joining us from the Mississippi of the Southwest, the otherwise known as the Blazing Inferno, Arizona. And we've got a terrific show lineup for you today. We're going to hit the ground running right now. We're going to discuss some of the things we're going to be talking about, and then we're going to have our special guest for the evening, and that is none other than Kathy Christensen, and she's a former CIA analyst, as was her late husband. She's written a few different books. On different issues on their experiences, but primarily with a strong focus on the Middle East crisis and the ongoing struggle for liberation that the people of Palestine, West Bank, Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and even those living within Israel, you know, find themselves in this ongoing persecution at the hands of Israel. And so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the Palestine Papers, which have not been covered barely at all by the U.S. corporate news, barely at all. And this was really big. We're talking about well over 1,000 pages, 1,000 documents that were unearthed and leaked to the press, primarily Al Jazeera. And they have put them out. They've uploaded all of it. You can go to Al Jazeera's website. Just go to Google, go to Al Jazeera English. And all the Palestinian papers are uploaded there for you to peruse through. But we're going to be talking about that. That's going to be the subtext of a much deeper contextual conversation that we're going to have about Palestine, its relationship to Israel, which has been extremely oppressive. And we're going to set that. And I think it's a great conversation and a show for us to have tonight, given the fact that we find within the world right now, us being global citizens and global neighbors, we see our brothers and sisters of Egypt struggling right now and fighting on valiantly and protesting until there is a complete regime change and the oppressive regime of Mubarak is removed. And I think it's important, you know, as we hear the media now talk about how Mubarak has been this oppressive dictator and repressive, which he has been. But what you don't see too much in the corporate media is a critical analysis of how he's been propped up. He's in essence been a puppet of the U.S. for quite some time. He's been a puppet of the U.S. and quite frankly been a puppet of Israel. But his heavy-handed military and very heavy-handed and brutal riot police. I mean, they've been the real, real brutal ones, have received direct military funding at the tune of about $1.3 billion per year. And so we're up in arms about that. But how often do we have this conversation about Israel? I mean, well, the U.S. Finances Israel to the tune of about $82 million per day. Yes, $82 million per day Israel gets, you know, on average from the United States of America. And what do they do with that? It goes to the military. It goes to their IDF. It goes to Mossad. It goes to their police, who quite frankly have been brutalizing Palestinians for quite some time. It's going to an apartheid state, a state that prevents Palestinians from even controlling their own water, their own resources, their own electricity. So we're going to get into all that within this show. It's going to be a really, really good show. And I've got Peter here on the show. And, Peter, I want to get your two cents as we I don't know if there's something you want to add to that kind of contextual plate that I tried to prepare for the feast that you and myself and our listeners are going to dine on for the next couple hours. Peter? Okay. I'm sorry, Peter. We had a difficulty. You can speak now. There was a little bit of a delay.
Oh, all right. Yeah, Salman, it's always good to be with you again. And, tonight's show is of special significance because of the range of issues that we're going to be focusing on and touching on, not all of them in great detail, but nevertheless, keeping in mind that the name of our program is Your World News, Your World News. And so tonight, you know, our focus is we have a global focus. All too often American media, and it's not unusual that the American media would ignore significant international developments. Their ignoring and downplaying of the Palestine Papers is of special significance. And we know that, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq, they dominate the news, obviously, because of America's imperial misadventures in those regions. You know, but just from where we sit today, you know, there's significant developments with the Palestine-Israeli conflict, which we're going to be getting into today, in addition to the uprisings in North Africa, particularly in Egypt and Tunisia and Algeria. We're seeing some historical developments in Sudan or South Sudan, perhaps. And so it's so appropriate that we pay close attention to world developments because, for working people, we need to be international in scope and we need to be international in our interests. And so we stand in solidarity with the Palestinians, the Egyptian working class, the working people of Tunisia, and all of those people who are struggling, even as we speak, for human liberation. So it's an exciting time to be able to discuss these developments and hopefully be a part of educating the American public, at least through our particular critical analysis. So I'm excited about these events, and I'm excited about having Ms. Christensen on the show tonight.
Right, and I'm glad you mentioned that and mentioned education. I'm sure we have some pretty sophisticated listeners, but you never know who's listening and who's listening on archive. And folks, don't let anyone fool you, all right? All right, don't let anyone fool you, all right? Especially the American media, maybe your civics class, your social studies class. Egypt is part of Africa. It's part of the Maghreb. It's part of Northern
right.
Africa, all right? I've met quite a few grown folk who chose to argue to the teeth that Egypt is part of the Middle East. Matter of fact, there was a time when the world referred to what we now look at as Saudi Arabia and that region as Northeast Africa, and that was, you know, just before World War One. But Egypt is part of Africa. It is part of the Africa. Yes, it is part of Africa, without a doubt. So, anyways, we're going to be joined by Kathleen Christensen soon, and we're going to get into a nice conversation with her for the next 40 minutes. So we won't be taking any calls during the interview because there's a lot of information that we want to get into. But afterwards, if you want to call in with your comments or questions, the number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. And, so just jot down any questions or comments, or I guess comments that you might have or that you want to unpack. Unfortunately, we're not going to be taking any calls during the interview for you to ask Ms. Christensen. But if you read her pieces on Counterpunch, she has her email there. And you can always email her directly, and maybe she'll give it to you on the towards the end of our interview. So we're going to have a brief musical interlude. After this song, this is an artist from the UK by the name of Low Key, and this is called Obama Nation. Obama Nation. Enjoy the song, and on the other end, we're going to get into the interview with Kathleen Christensen.
This track is not an attack upon the American people. It's an attack upon the system within which they live. Since 1945, the United States has attempted to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments. In the process, the U.S. has caused the end of life for several million people and condemned many millions more to a life of agony and despair. The strength of your dreaming prevents you from reason. The American dream only makes sense if you're sleeping. It's just a cruel fantasy. Their politics took my voice away, but their music gave it back to me. The land where they're lumping are consumed by consumption, killing themselves to shovel down food in abundance. I guess a rapper from Britain is a rare voice. America is capitalism on steroids. Natives kept in casinos and reservations. This place slaves never given reparations. Take everything from Native Americans and wonder why I call it the racist experiment. Afraid of your melanin, the same as it's ever been. That ain't gonna change with the race of the president. I see him. Imperialism under your skin tone. You could call it Christopher Columbus syndrome.
Is it Obama's nation or an abomination? Is it Obama's nation or an abomination? Is it Obama's nation or an abomination? Does it make any difference when they form your nation? Is it Obama's nation or an abomination?
Entertainer, the world's devastator, from Venezuela to Mesopotamia. Your cameras lie cause they have to hide the savage crimes committed on leaders that happen to try and nationalize eating competitions while the world's been starving. Beat up communism with the help of Bin Laden. Where would your war of terror be without that man? Every day you create more Nidal Hassan. Killer man from the military, you're a weirdo. But killer wog from the Middle East, you're a hero. Your country is causing screams that never reach your ear holes. America inflicted a million ground zeros. Follow the dollar and swallow your humanity. Soldiers committing savagery you never even have to see. Those mad at me writing emails angrily. I'm not anti-America, America is anti-me.
Is it Obama's nation or an abomination? Is it Obama's nation or an abomination? Is it Obama's nation or an abomination? Doesn't make it.
That was Low Key, and that was just a little snippet. We're going to play the rest of the song at the end of the show. But without further ado, I wanted to welcome on, give a warm, warm, radical Your World News welcome from Peter Fowler and myself and the rest of the Your World News crew to Kathleen Christensen. And Kathleen, are you on?
I am on. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you for allowing to spend the next half hour or so with us on the show. We know you have a busy schedule with the Palestine papers as well as what's going on right now in Egypt and what we've seen go on in Tunisia and as well as in Yemen.
Yeah, I thank you for having me. Thanks.
Oh, no problem. Well, I want to start with the first question, and then Peter will have the second question. The first question, I just wanted to know if you could just give a kind of a brief context of your work with the Central Intelligence Agency. And, you know, there have been the likes of Thomas Johnson and as well as John Stockwell and others who have worked within that agency and then have had an about face in terms of their ideologies and philosophies and so forth. And I believe you even were a past supporter of Ronald Reagan. I think you mentioned that you voted for him the first time around. I just want to know what kind of work did you do, and how did you have this about face? How did it come about?
Well, I guess it's a long story. It was certainly a slow evolution. I worked at the CIA. I left the CIA 32 years ago this month, with my husband, who also worked there. We were both analysts. He was a higher-level official than I. In other words, we were not on the operational side of the house. We were not spooks and operatives. We mostly sat at desks and did analysis. I sort of entered the CIA through the back door because my mother worked there, and so it was sort of became almost the natural thing to do. And it was an interesting job because it was analytical. I didn't have to skulk around corners and meet with agents or do dirty tricks or anything like that. It was a sort of an intellectual job, and it was quite sort of exciting to think that maybe the things you wrote were going to policymakers and so on. And I worked first on Vietnam for several years, and then in the, I guess it was like 1971, I changed to work on the Middle East. So I've actually been working on the Middle East now for 40 years. I hate to admit I've done anything for that long. But I learned a lot. But then my husband retired in 1979, early 79. They have quite a good retirement program if you have the right number of years in service and years overseas and so on. And he could retire at 50, which he did. And I quit at the same time because I didn't want to work while he was home writing what he thought was going to be the great American novel. We both tried that, and that didn't work. And then I got back into writing substantively on the Middle East, which I had worked on in the last several years at the CIA, and my evolution and my husband's evolution from being loyal CIA employees to being really fairly radical came about really gradually over the years from 1979 until probably over 20 years. We had both become much more liberal well before 20 years were up, by the early 90s. And it continued, and I guess our radicalism would date from more or less over the last decade, since 9/11 and before, a little bit before that. Part of the change was just getting away from Washington. We moved to Santa Fe. We left the CIA in early 79, moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico in late 79, and getting away from that that sort of atmosphere, wonkish atmosphere in Washington was a great help. We have come to see how normal people live in this country, and got a better perspective. I did, as you said, to my great regret, vote for Ronald Reagan the first time, and I think he had a lot to do with changing my political viewpoint too, driving me away from conservative positions. So that's where I am. I have always been, now, in the CIA, of course, you're not supposed to be anybody's advocate, but in the, and I don't think I really was, And I think actually working in the CIA gave me a pretty clear, honest picture of what was going on in the Palestinian-Israeli situation, which is my primary area. And I've become more like that since leaving. And when I write mostly for the website Counterpunch, and there I can be an advocate and I can have opinions and so on. And I have am now, and I think really always have been, a Palestinian rights advocate. That doesn't mean I oppose, I'm certainly not anti-Semitic, I don't oppose Jewish rights, but I think Israel has been just oppressing the Palestinians terribly, worse and worse every year for the last 60 plus years, and I think it's very important to speak out on that.
Right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Kathleen, Peter Fowler again. It's good to have you on.
Yeah.
You know, as a longtime veteran of Middle East analysis and having your particular insight, could you first of all tell us, particularly for folks who may not be yet familiar with what the Palestine Papers are, just tell us basically, just real briefly, what the Palestine Papers are. And then from your, you know, with all your insight and experience, tell us why are they so important? What is the impact and the significance of these documents that we're calling the Palestine Papers?
Okay. The Palestine Papers were released last week over a 4 or 5 day period by Al Jazeera. They are not part of the WikiLeaks, you know, the 250,000 cables, U.S. State Department cables that have been released by WikiLeaks. These were all Al Jazeera somehow gained access to these papers. I think there are almost 1,700 of them. They all seem to come, everyone I've seen referred to, comes from Palestinian sources. And they are documents that cover a decade of the peace negotiations, the Palestinians' peace negotiations with Israel and maneuverings with the United States and so on. They date from 1999 to 2010, fairly late in the year, I think. And they all, as I say, deal with the peace process and the negotiations. And they all come; they are all Palestinian, official Palestinian documents, notes of memoranda, you know, to around internally in the Palestinian apparatus, and memos of conversation and so on, briefing papers, and reports on, for instance, meetings with George Mitchell, the U.S. envoy, and meetings with Netanyahu and so on. And the reason that they have caused such a flurry of attention, diverted only by what's going on in Egypt more recently, is that they reveal really graphically, dramatically, how many concessions the Palestinians have made to the Israelis over the, or been willing to make over the last decade, and they also reveal quite graphically how uninterested the Israelis have been in those concessions. I mean, the Palestinian officials have offered the Israelis just about everything that the Palestinians have stood for over the years on a silver platter, and the Israelis have still said no. The Palestinians, according to these documents, which appear to be very genuine, have given away pretty much all of the right, their position on the Palestinian right of return, that is the right of the refugees who fled or were expelled in 1948 and have never been allowed to return, their right to return, you know, under international human rights law. The Palestinians were willing to make huge concessions on that, and the Israelis were not particularly interested. On territory, they were willing to concede Israel's right to annex enough settlements, Israeli settlements inside the West Bank, primarily in the Jerusalem area, but in other areas as well, that would give away, first of all, prime real estate in the West Bank, give it over to Israeli control, of course, the Israelis control it now, but this would be control with Palestinian acquiescence, and the Israelis could, with a peace agreement, exercise sovereignty over these areas. These are also the areas, the settlements in these areas, Israeli settlements in these areas, house 400,000 Israeli settlers, and there are a total of only 500,000 Israeli settlers. So 80% of the Israeli settlers would come under, according to this Palestinian concession, would come under Israeli sovereignty. And in return, the Palestinians would get an equal amount of territory, but in a very unattractive area, just on the edges of Gaza, which is a fairly desolate area, not as fertile and not as built up and so on. And so those are the kinds of and in Jerusalem, the Palestinians were willing to give Israel to agree that Israel could annex and exercise sovereignty over all of the Jewish settlements that have been built over the years inside East Jerusalem, all except one major one. And still the Israelis said no. So this is what is really very interesting in these papers. And another thing that has been revealed is how much the United States has sided with Israel, how much pressure the United States, U.S. negotiators such as George Mitchell were putting on the Palestinians to make these concessions and not to push the Israelis, not to make too many demands of the Israelis. I mean, it was really, I think, shameful how little pressure it is shown in these papers that the United States has put on Israel and how much pressure it is put on the Palestinians.
Right.
So that's the reason for the excitement sort of over these Palestine papers.
Right.
Thank you.
Kathy, one of the things I'd like to mention, and I put it out there, I've been a long said, and I think our listeners know, it's just kind of shameful that folks like yourself, myself, Peter, that when we criticize Israel, the first thing that, you know, many within, you know, is the Israel government or people that are pro-Israel and their repressive policies towards Palestinians, one of the first things they try to do is try to, you know, claim it must be anti-Semitic charge, which is totally bogus. We're saying nothing about Judaism, saying nothing about anyone of the Jewish faith whatsoever. We're talking about the policies of this government towards a large segment of people who are basically, as people have described, the Gaza Strip, you know, the largest open air prison in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, and if if anyone was opposed to what the white South African minority regime was doing to black South Africans, if you were opposed to that, you know, by principle, you must be opposed to, you know, what is going on with Palestinians at the hand of the Israeli government.
Yeah.
One of the things my question is one of the revelations that kind of stuck out for me, and I was wondering if you could shed some context for our listeners, is that what we see or what we don't see actually in a lot of the papers is a voice from Hamas. And as we know, Hamas was elected in 2006, you know, they won those elections in 2006,
uh-huh.
But the Palestinian Authority in and of itself was something that was founded in 1994 and was only supposed to be around for 5 years, and we still see it. But Mahmoud Abbas has been, you know, the so-called, you know, voice of the Palestinians, and the U.S., and it's fine if he's at the table, but why not Hamas at the table? The U.S. refuses to speak to them. They've labeled them a terrorist organization, you know, but not labeled the IDF as a terrorist organization. If you can give us some context about the Palestinian Authority, like the PLO, obviously Fatah underneath that, and you know what this means, that there is no you know, representative of all political forces within Gaza and West Bank.
Yeah, you're exactly right on your last point that there is no single representative of the Palestinians that would represent Gaza and the West Bank, and also the refugees who are, you know, the 4+ million, 4.5 million roughly, Palestinian refugees who are in camps. Not all of them are in camps, but there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from 1948 and their descendants who are not also not represented by the Palestinian Authority, which is supposed to be the voice of the Palestinians, as you say. You're right that Hamas was elected in a democratic, internationally supervised, attested to be free and fair and all that stuff, elections in 2006, January 2006, just 5 years ago. And they won a majority in the legislature, and they had the right to appoint a prime minister. Fatah, of course, didn't like this, but first of all, the United States and Israel didn't like it. Israel didn't, I mean, the United States didn't like it because, largely because Israel is totally opposed to Hamas and totally opposed to talking to Hamas. And it was Israel, at Israel's instigation, that the blockade of Gaza was established, implemented by the United States and, unfortunately, Europe and the rest of the international community right after the election in January 2006. And then there was still a Fatah presence in Gaza for about a year and a half until June of 2007. And then the United States, and this has been this is also documented in these Palestine papers released just last week, but there was also a very interesting Vanity Fair article that exposed all of this in, I forget exactly when, several years ago. The United States planned with the security chief of Fatah, a man named Mohammed Dahlan, who's a ruthless, brutal guy, planned to launch a coup in Gaza against Hamas in order to overthrow it and just get rid of it altogether. Hamas got word that this was coming, and they launched a counter coup, or I guess a preemptive coup is what you would say, and they too were fairly brutal, but they won to the great consternation of Fatah and its United States sponsors. So this happened in June of 2007. That caused the international community and the U.S. and Israel to tighten the blockade even more. And of course, in response to the blockade and the terrible imprisonment of Gazans, of Hamas and various other factions in Gaza began firing rockets into Israel, which gave Israel the excuse that it wanted to launch repeated attacks into Gaza, that including and culminating sort of in the horrible assault on Gaza lasting 3 weeks. From the end of 2008 until I think January 18th it was of 2009, 2 days before Obama was inaugurated, in the midst of all of this, that's the sort of the Hamas story. They have been doing their best to run a government and run a little territory without which has no access to the outside world. Very little is let in. Everything that comes in is controlled by Israel. This includes everything from food to cement to rebuild buildings and houses that were destroyed in the assault 2 years ago. The exit and entry of people into and out of Gaza is also controlled by the Israelis, and they don't let people out if they don't want to, and they don't let many visitors in, and so on. So, as you said, it is the world's biggest open-air prison. It is just a 1.5 million people in an area of about 140 square miles. It's just an abysmal situation. But in the meantime, the Palestinian Authority, which is mostly Fatah, is totally opposed to Hamas, almost as much as Israel and the United States are, and it has been cooperating with Israel to suppress Hamas and the its own fellow Palestinians in Gaza. Mahmoud Abbas, who is the Palestinian president, the president of the Palestinian Authority, was elected to a four-year term in 2005, also January 2005, which means that his term expired in 2009, and there were never any further elections held because everybody knew he would lose the election. The U.S. knew, he knew, Israel knew, and so the U.S. never pushed him to hold more elections, and he's just sort of been drifting along with, under U.S. tutelage. So the Palestinian Authority is not a democratic institution. There's a great deal of opposition to it on the streets of the West Bank, where it, the only place it has any control at all, none in Gaza. And so the Palestinians are split. It's a classic divide and conquer situation. And unfortunately, the Palestinian Authority people, Abbas and his negotiators, who are the ones who have been negotiating away all these Palestinian rights that I was just describing, as described in the Palestine Papers, they are. I forget where I was going with this sentence, but it isn't not a legitimate government. It's not a popular government, and if these popular demonstrations in Egypt and Tunisia and so on, if that fever sort of catches on, we could well see demonstrations in by Palestinians against their own government as well. So.
Right. Peter, thank you.
That's some profound information, Kathleen. The Palestinian authorities are no longer a democratic institution with President Mahmoud Abbas, his term expiring fully 2 years ago,
yeah,
and Hamas not being recognized certainly by the United States. Yet and still, the President of the United States just last week said in front of the world, and I quote, "Let us be clear: the United States of America stands with the people of Tunisia and supports the democratic aspirations of all people." Now, in light of the fact that the PA president is not, he's no longer democratically supported. The PA is not even a legitimate government in that sense. The negotiations revealed by the Palestine Papers reveal the United States government subverting the democratic process. In your opinion, is this process, this so-called peace process that started, several years back now, is this even remotely democratic in relation to the Palestinian people? And what does this whole process and the revelations to the inside goings on, what does that say about the Palestinian people's right of the self-determination, which the United States, at least in its rhetoric, claims to be so important?
Yeah, well, the U.S. claims have always been just rhetoric. They talk about self-determination for everybody, but as was evident in the Hamas elections during the Bush administration, they were claiming that the Iraq war was started to promote democracy, and the Afghan war was started to promote democracy in Afghanistan, and it would have a ripple effect around the whole Middle East and so on, and they were all for democracy promotion until somebody they didn't like was democratically elected. So the Obama administration, I'm afraid, is just as hypocritical. Obama and company they favor democracy when it isn't inconvenient for them. They haven't quite known what to do in Egypt because they would like Mubarak, they would like the situation as it existed 10 days ago when there was peace on the streets and the Egyptians were not demonstrating against Mubarak because Mubarak is a dictator and has been doing the U.S. bidding for three decades now, and the U.S. would be just as happy to keep him in place undemocratically because he does do our bidding. Same in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi monarchs are obviously not a democratic government. But if there's turmoil there, and our oil interests are possibly in danger if the U.S. is going to have a fit. And Jordan is not democratic. We don't have any huge interests in Jordan, except that Abdullah is a friendly monarch.
Right.
But so the United States is just amazingly hypocritical, and all of these WikiLeaks, the street demonstrations and the WikiLeaks documents and the Palestine papers have shown really graphically and dramatically just how hypocritical the United States is.
Right. We just have a couple more questions. This is my last question, and Peter has one last question. And my last question is it's kind of a quasi two-part question, but it's quick. Number one is why, and maybe it's obvious, why does the U.S. continue to support Israel? I mean, maybe it's a silly question, because the U.S. And regardless of who is in office continue to show themselves as like some of the biggest hypocrites. The hypocrisy, I mean, we choose, or, and I hate using that pronoun, the U.S. government chooses who, which dictator it's going to support, and which dictators, or I should say, which dictators are going to support, which ones they vilify, and then also which democratically elected leaders, like Hugo Chavez, that they're going to lambast and vilify,
yeah,
and throw out all these misconceptions and basically obfuscate and mislead the American populace into thinking that Hugo Chavez is a dictator, which he's not. And the second part of my question is, what can you tell our listeners? What do you think, what needs to be done on the ground here in the U.S. For us to help bring about independence in Palestine? And what needs to, or and just, I guess, broader, not even just to take it out even the hands of the U.S. people, because that may be part of your answer, but what needs to happen for the people of Palestine to finally have sovereignty, to have independence, and have the ability to determine their own destiny? What needs to happen?
Well, the first question is easier to answer than the second one. I think the answer to your question about why we support Israel so unquestioningly is that there is a very strong pro-Israel lobby in this country, and I'm defining lobby the way John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, who wrote a book on this years ago, I guess, called the Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. They define it, and I think this is a perfect definition because it's broad enough to encompass the entire lobby, and I'm not sure I have the words exactly right here, but a conglomeration or a coalition of individuals and organizations, and that's important. It isn't just AIPAC, for instance, it isn't just organizations, it's individuals also, conglomeration of individuals and organizations who work, one of whose primary objectives is to lead to form policy, foreign policy, in a pro-Israel direction. So this includes AIPAC, the main pro-Israel lobby organization. It includes all of the major Jewish American organizations. It includes Christian Zionists, who are very, very pro-Israeli these days, because they think that the Israel's existence is a fulfillment of biblical prophecies. It includes many media organizations who are pro-Israeli, either out of sentiment and so-called principle, or out of fear of being besieged by letter writers, for instance, who are pro-Israeli. And it includes a lot of individuals, such as the neocons who were in the Bush administration. I mean, during the Bush administration, we had the part of the Israeli lobby right in government. People like Richard Perle and Elliot Abrams and, Paul Wolfowitz, who was the Undersecretary of Defense, and Douglas Feith and so on. I mean, these people were clearly working for Israel on Israel's in Israel's benefit, and there they were right in the U.S. government. there are also a few now nowadays too. I mean, Dennis Ross, for instance, who came from the first Bush administration through the Clinton administration, then was out of office but still working for an Israeli lobby organization, and is now back in the Obama administration. These people are pro-Israel lobbyists, and they, you know, there has been, particularly since the Holocaust and the creation of Israel, a lot of very genuine sympathy for Israel and sympathy for Jews and their need, sympathy for their need for a homeland and a refuge and so on in the United States. And the lobby has capitalized on this and made sure that this kind of popular sympathy ends up influencing policy and directing policy. And media organs, as I say, have done this as well. And as a result, the lobby has been able to influence and mold opinion. Popular opinion, media opinion, and policymaker opinion. And it has also, and this is key, critical, used money, campaign contributions, to keep Congress in line. I mean, it is almost impossible for a congressman or any politician to criticize Israel. Because, as you said earlier, criticism of Israel is jumped on as supposedly being anti-Semitic. And, a lot of congressmen have lost elections who did back in the 80s, for instance, Paul Findlay in Illinois and Charles Percy, also in Illinois, a senator, were clearly targeted by the pro-Israel lobby, and they lost their elections. And this is very edifying for has been edifying for congressmen and senators for the last, however long that's been, 25 or 30 years. They don't want that to happen to them, and they don't want to lose the campaign contributions, and so they go along with whatever Israel wants. So that, I think, is the major answer to your first question. Another very important aspect of this is that the U.S. gives Israel $3 billion a year in cash, in military aid, and the only condition on that aid is that it has to spend 74%. I don't know why the odd number, but 74% on purchasing U.S.-made arms, which means that the U.S. military-industrial complex also benefits from our aid to Israel, which makes them part of this pro-Israel lobby because, of course, they want to be able to continue to give arms to Israel, arms that the United States government pays for. So that's why it is so very hard for any politician, any president, any administration to back away from Israel. Which then leads me into the second question about what we do about this, and boy, that is very difficult because, Barack Obama tried to put some pressure on Israel, for instance, just to freeze settlement construction, which was a fairly minor step, a minor demand on them. He wasn't asking for the dismantlement of any settlements or anything like that. He just wanted them to stop constructing new housing units and stop expanding the settlements. And even that was only temporary, and still the Israelis balked. And Obama felt that he could not push the Israelis any further because he would get this this blowback himself. Blowback, I don't think is quite the right word, but criticism, as he did, from the Jewish community, and his own reelection would be endangered and so on and so forth. So it is so hard. What we American people can do is it's hard to figure out because it's almost impossible to push a politician who is fearful of his very continuance in office because of this lobby. I mean, how do we pressure Obama? How do we pressure our own congressmen who have the same fear? Now there is some movement. There's a BDS movement, as they call it, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is very small, but it is growing a little bit in the United States, the idea being to boycott Israeli-made products, divest, try to get companies, big companies that invest in Israel quite a lot, like Caterpillar, which builds bulldozers with which Israel destroys Palestinian homes and uproots olive trees and so on. Motorola has a big investment in Israel and so on. These companies are targets of the divestment campaign so far, not much success with the campaign, and then sanctions, which would be trying to get the U.S. not to diminish U.S. aid, cut off or diminish U.S. aid to Israel. Now, that's a really tall order, but anyway, there is some grassroots movement, actually in the scheme of things, or compared to in the past, quite a lot of grassroots movement in opposition to Israel, either through this BDS movement or just criticism. There's some more criticism of Israel in the press and so on, but it's such a small effort so far that it's, I think we have to keep going. But it's very easy to become hopeless, and that's all I can think to do. I think that's all any activist, any Palestinian rights advocate, Palestinian solidarity advocate or activist can think to do. And that is the only way the poor Palestinians are ever going to get their self-determination, is if the United States stops supporting Israel, which would mean, or which would certainly help, get Israel off the Palestinians' back. But, boy, what a tall order.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. My last question, Kathy, is a potentially two-part question, but I'll let you decide whether you want to address the second part. The first part of it is with regard to kind of picking up where you left off in terms of the destiny of the Palestinians. And, we've touched on the ideals of democracy and self-determination that are purported to be the guiding lights of American policy, both foreign and domestic. With the best interests of the Palestinians in mind, what would be the genuine pursuit of democracy and self-determination in your estimation? We've heard a lot about, these negotiations and peace talks and resettling and return of rights of return and one-state solution, two-state solution. There's a lot of verbiage out there, but just in your estimation, given your experience, what would that look like? A genuine pursuit of democracy and self-determination for the best interest of the Palestinian peoples. And then the second part, if you want to go there, is given the context of the rest of the region. In the rest of the other areas in the Middle East and North Africa now, what would that look like for some other people who are also rising up in the interest of democracy and self-determination?
what is the best way to carry out democracy? I think the most just solution in the Palestinian for the Palestinian-Israeli situation conflict. Certainly not realizable any time in the near future, though, is a single-state solution. You don't have to call it a state necessarily, but some situation in which Jews, who have rights also, Jews not necessarily Israelis, the Jews who live there, and Palestinians live as equal citizens, live in equality. The two-state solution, which would give the Palestinians a state in less than one quarter of their original homeland, in 22% of, this is assuming that the Israelis pulled back, got out of the settlements and pulled back to the 1967 lines. The best the Palestinians could expect under a two-state solution is 22% of Palestine. This would be a teeny territory surrounded on three sides by Israel, Israeli territory. And that is, I don't think that's fair. The Palestinians were right now have, in terms of population, in historic Palestine, that is between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, are at population parity with Jews. There are an equal number, more or less, of Palestinians and Jews. So you can confine the Palestinians to one quarter of the territory. That is not fair. And, of course, that also leaves out all the Palestinian refugees. So I think the only just solution and the only way to achieve real democracy in that land is to have a situation in which Jews and Palestinians, as I said, live as equal citizens, each having equal access to the instruments of government and so on. Now, that isn't on the horizon anytime soon unless Israel just collapses, which is not impossible, but it isn't going to happen tomorrow for sure. And then what I'm not sure I actually understand your second question. Is it that what would a solution like this mean for the rest of the Arab world? Is that what you meant?
I guess I'm I mean the in relation to the anti-democratic situation that the U.S. seems to be fostering right now. What would the kind of democracy and self-determination look like, for example, best case scenario, of course, for example, in Egypt right now, or in Tunisia, or in Iraq or Afghanistan, some of these other regions where there's
a lot of power. I see. Yeah, well, the best case scenario, also probably not realizable anytime soon, but Saudi Arabia should also be included in this, is a situation in which these countries have are allowed to vote, have all citizens of the country, of each country, are allowed to, you know, have an equal voice in voting for their government and so on. This is what I think the Egyptian people on the street, men on the street, actually the primary objective of the people, the Egyptians on the street, is just to get rid of Mubarak. But I think that if people ask them, and if they really thought about what they wanted after Mubarak falls, if he does, would be a democratic government in which they could have a voice in their government. I don't think it would necessarily be, I don't think in any of these countries that it would be an Islamic government. You know, Hamas won in Gaza, in both Gaza and the West Bank in 2006. It won that election not because it is an Islamic fundamentalist. In fact, I think most Palestinians oppose it for that reason, think it is too rigid and too Islamic. But it won because it was the party that was standing up for Palestinian rights, and it was not corrupt, as Fatah is corrupt, was then and still is, widely recognized. And Fatah, as in the in its governing scenario in the Palestinian Authority, was caving into Israel and the U.S. constantly. It was not standing up for Palestinian rights. So I'm going on too long here, but the reason Hamas was elected was a secular reason. It wasn't because it was Islamic. It was a political reason because it was, as I said, standing up for Palestinian rights, and it was clean, not corrupt. And so this would be the objective of any the best case scenario in any Arab country, and all of these demonstrators on the street, I think that this would be their optimum goal. Would be a secular government in which they could have peace and at least some access to prosperity. So I'm not sure that's a very good answer, and it isn't, once again, not something that's going to happen anytime soon. But
no,
maybe the administrations.
Yeah, that definitely gets at what I was driving at, just in terms of your opinion on that. So I thank you for that insight.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we know you have a lot of writing and researching to catch up on. And I told our listeners before we got online with you that they can catch a lot of your work on Counterpunch, which is
an article
phenomenal
today,
website.
As a matter of fact, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is on one WikiLeaks cable, which shows the U.S. trying to go after Al Jazeera, which is interesting, 2 years ago, but relevant to today.
Okay, and that's on counterpunch.org, right?
That's right, uh-huh.
And you've written some books. Before we get out, could you tell listeners where they can, they might be able to find your books and,
Yeah, the there are three books. One co-authored with my husband, my late husband. All of them are available on Amazon. One of them, called "The Wound of Dispossession: Telling the Palestinian Story," is out of print, but used booksellers that advertise or you know, to which you can get access through Amazon, have that book. The first book, published about a decade ago, I guess, is called "Perceptions of Palestine: Their Influence on U.S. Middle East Policy." This is a history of U.S. policymaking on the Palestinian issue. And the most recent one is called "Palestine in Pieces: Graphic Perspectives on the Israeli Occupation." My husband and I wrote this together based on our 8 trips to Palestine since 2003. And it is, a graphic description of the occupation and what Palestinians have to endure under the Israeli thumb. And
right.
they're all available through Amazon. So.
Okay. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
You know, Your World News is always home for you. So we hope sometime in the future we might be able to have you on again. But on behalf of Peter and our listeners and the rest of Your World News folks, thank you so much.
Well, this has been great. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that was Kathleen Christensen, and I hope you definitely take the time to check out her work. It's really good stuff, and I've been reading her stuff for a little while, but when these Palestinian leaks broke, I just thought that this was just a great opportunistic time to get her on. So with that being said, we're going to take a short interlude, and we're going to come back, and Peter and I are going to talk about some things regarding U.S. hypocrisy, looking at that whole region, whether it's the Maghreb or whether it is Palestine, but just look kind of really sinking our teeth into U.S. foreign policy regarding its support of selective dictators and its vilification of those who are not dictators, but those who are actually more democratic than any president or any government or any administration this country has ever seen. So it makes me think of mutiny, you know. So if you're on the U.S. foreign policy ship, it's time to overturn it, jump ship. And without further ado, this is The Coup. Featuring Black Thought. Black Thought is one of the illest MCs out there, period. And Talib Kweli, this is my favorite mutiny.
If you got the nerve, lash out for your just desserts. It's not just the word. Some of y'all heads up in the clouds. I'ma bring y'all back to earth. It's black, black, and burn. Bullshit y'all talk about. Out your mouth, I'm not concerned. Cause y'all got to learn. It's y'all turned like Detroit Red. When it said had an ultra perm. The long walk, I heard your bare heels, so throw on your boots. The game camouflage like army suit. But I can see it more clear cause I came with the coupe in here. Ring the alarm, inform the truth. Send them out into the world, go to war in the blue. Eye to eye with the enemy you sworn to shoot. Now I'm coming at your neck, stick a hand, something wrong with me. Motherfucker, something wrong with you. When the chief just way too smart to question. The enemy, the brothers of a dark complexion. The governments of the world is shark infested. They have their own weaponry like Charlton Heston, man. Look, it gets low, man. Yeah. Low, now I'm talking about. Get it. My basic statement, I spit street stories till I take the pavement, trying to stay out the pier where we face enslavement, had a foolproof puzzle till they trace the payments, I was gripping my palm around some shitty rum, trying
trying to find Psalm number 151. Forget what I'm old as I clutch the commodore. Put down the bottle and come get the gun. I get off the chain like Kunta Kinte with a Mac 10. They want a zone like a dollar and a crack then. Subtly subtract this T's and C's. Mind cloudy through the weeds and flim. I'm in my brain off of that and the Jesus him. We waiting for the time to fight Jesus in. Telling us to relax while they ease it in. We getting greased again. The truth I write is so cold it'll freeze my pen. I boots rider, it's a pleasure to meet you. Never let they punk ass ever defeat you. They got us on the corner wearing pleather and see-through. All y'all's gold mines, they want to deplete you. I ain't just finna rap on the track, I'm finna clap on the back. And it's the second of that. 500 years before Iceberg ever leaned back in the lap. Before they told Rosa Black in the back. Before the CIA told Ricky Ross to put crack in the sack. The Hills got traded rapping for smack. This beat alone should get platinum plaque. I'd rather see a million of us ecstatic to scrap. Cause if we rapping them back, we automatically stack. Check it out.
In the Middle East are trembling. From the streets of Tunis to Alexandria to Cairo, tens of thousands are demanding not only democracy, but an end to their dictatorships. Dictatorships that are, by the way, armed and supported by the U.S. Empire. What drove these people into the streets were the wiki revelations of the puppetry, corruption, and servility of their leaders to U.S. and Western interests. Many of these leaders, who've led for lifetimes, have amassed enormous wealth while generations of youth pass through life jobless, unfulfilled, and brutally bullied by the police forces of the dictatorships, often police trained, equipped, or both by U.S. agencies. WikiLeaks revealed American diplomatic cables reflecting U.S. knowledge and acquiescence of their puppet state's corruption, torture, and brutality. They didn't care how cruel nor corrupt these countries were. As long as they served U.S. interests, that is, stability or quiet in the face of U.S., Western, or Israeli aggression in the region. Egypt receives billions of U.S. bucks every year to buttress its dictatorship. This spate of rebellions in Muslim states is especially important given the recent news that many leaders were privately urging the U.S. to attack Iran. For this shows that few spoke for their people. They spoke for a narrow, parasitical ruling clique. If change comes to the region, it won't be because of U.S. efforts, but in spite of them. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Yeah, and that was our man, Mumia Abu-Jamal. And so let's hit the ground running. That was... Peter, that was an exceptional interview with Kathy Christensen, if I must say so myself. And I just thought that she provided a lot of quality insight into information, news and information regarding, you know, that part of the world, Palestine, which Israel is a part of Palestine. Let's not forget that. You know, that is seldom found on the corporate media, and this is amazing. You know, we sit here and we do this for free, but you have these nitwits, these disingenuous hacks, media hacks, you know, that are can be found on any one of these corporate media television stations, television outlets, whether it's MSNBC or Nightline on ABC, or, you know, obviously CNN, do I need to say Fox News? And they get paid millions of dollars to report, to provide information and insight on news information. Now, yes, they're the commentary shows, and we expect to get that. But even looking at just the straight reporting of news, whether it's, you know, because they all have their straight news, you know, so-called news desk, whether it's Greta Van Susteren or Britt Hume on Fox News, or if it's one of these other programs on MSNBC where they have like the news for 2 hours, you know, they have a period of that every day. CNN, of course, those folks that are supposed to report the news objectively and to report information, they categorically just habitually omit this kind of information that Kathy Christensen just provided us for the past 50 or so minutes, and it is without a doubt, they have, and I'm going to say it, Peter, they without a doubt they have blood on their hands, and they have blood all over the microphone, all over those tainted microphones that they use. They have blood all over it, and what I mean by that is that their omission, their deliberate omission, not accidental, not fortuitous, but their deliberate omission of critical information that could help people make informed decision about public consent for what their government has been doing, you know, information that could start to create a public dialogue, a true democratic public dialogue as to how their tax dollars are being spent, and also how their tax dollars are not being spent because of how they're being spent. They omit that. And at the same time, Peter, there are people that are dying. And so it's not just people are being oppressed in places like Palestine with U.S. dollars, U.S. taxpayer dollars that taxpayers like myself and yourself have no say whatsoever. It's not just that people are being oppressed, Peter. It is that people are dying. There are children that need what we would consider basic medical treatment that are not able to get that treatment in Gaza Strip, not in Gaza City, not in Ramallah, you know what I'm saying? You know, and because they're not able to get basic medical treatment, they often die. This is something that's not talked about. So, yeah, we talk about, you know, 2009, 2010, you know, Operation Cast Lead, you know, and, you know, the impact of bombs, you know, being dropped, you know, killing 1,300 Palestinians, close to 50% of them being, you know, children. And so, you know, we really didn't hear too much about that side in the corporate media, but those, you know, but when they did mention it, you know, people get like kind of like a half-ass vision of that. But what gets lost in the shuffle is that every single week in West Bank and Gaza, you have folks that are dying. You have children that are dying, that are literally dying. You have an unemployment over 70%. We're sitting here bellyaching about this unemployment rate here, which is bad, but compared to 70%, it's almost not even worth mentioning. So we're talking about, and we're talking about, you know, people crammed into small quarters, We're talking about a strip of land. We have where there's over 1.3 million people. All right. No regular access to water, electricity. They're lucky if they get 6 hours of electricity a day, and you have people dying every week because of the repression that is coming from Tel Aviv, that is coming from Israel, and it is financed and supported by the U.S., the United States of America, and their government. And you have these hacks that fail to mention that fail to put a face to that. But I don't anyone call in and try to say, oh, well, that's not their job to talk about that. Well, they make it their job when they talk about other things. If they want to talk about Chavez, they'll trump up something and talk about, you know, the poverty in Venezuela. Not talking about how the poverty has gone down significantly, you know, within the last, you know, 12 years. Under Chavez, they're not going to talk about how he's pretty much almost completely eradicated illiteracy and brought, you know, brought literacy missions and medical missions into favelas, medical missions that were inspired by the Cubans into favelas. And you don't erase, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of white supremacy, white Spanish supremacy in 12 years. It is incremental steps, but what Chavez has done is very, 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 very commendable and mighty. But anyways, Peter, and I'll stop here. It's sick, folks. If we don't wake up, now, some of you may not know this. Some of you may know know the stuff that we've been talking about. For those of you this is information for the first time, the ball's in your court. What are you gonna do? What are you gonna do with this information? What are you gonna do? Like I said, Peter, I don't get paid for this. For this radio podcast that we do. We don't get paid for it, but this is one of the things that we try to do with what's going on, and that is raising the specter of consciousness by using this platform, by using our words, you know, articles that we write. This is what we're trying to do, and this is what a lot of folks that are listening right now do. A lot of folks that are listening right now are part of the BDS movement that get on that protest that mention things in their classroom, mention things in their households, in their communities, and that is a part of it. That's part of it. For those of you that this is information, you have to follow that trend, and you have to be that inconvenient hero. You have to bring up this stuff in your communities with your families. Don't let somebody scare you into not criticizing Israel by trying to throw the anti-Semitic thing out there, which is, you know, is completely bogus anyways, you know, but, you know, even the whole labeling of Semitic, since there are many different languages and people who use Semitic languages within their culture that fall under that rubric anyway. So, you know, someone that says, oh, you're anti-Semitic, you know, what does that mean? That mean I'm anti-Arab as well. I'm anti Ethiopians who speak Amharic too, since Amharic is a Semitic language, but that's a whole other thing. You must speak up. You must speak up, because these brutal dictatorships, like this one, like the one of Sukarno, or I should say Suharto in Indonesia, Suharto and the brutal dictatorship of Suharto, and how he just pummeled over 300,000 lives into oblivion in that genocide, which was supported by the U.S. as well, which was a convenient relationship for the U.S. All right, as was Saddam Hussein. But you know, some of us know that. But some of the less popular ones, like Suharto, these are brutal dictatorships that have been supported by the U.S. Anastasio Somoza, you know what I'm saying? That dictatorship. Papa Doc, Baby Doc. These are dictatorships that have been supported by the U.S. Rafael Trujillo in Dominican Republic. And Peter, it's yours, but I end on this. the Parsley Massacre, folks, since we're talking about Haitians, the Parsley Massacre, Rafael Trujillo sent in troops, Dominican troops, to the border, and they systematically gunned down anywhere from 10,000 to 18,000 black Haitians, called the Parsley Massacre by Rafael Trujillo, all right? Okay? And so, you know, we've got to stop this crap, man. We got to stop this crap. Silence is betrayal, as Dr. King said. Silence is betrayal. Speak up. The corporate media has blood on their microphones. They got blood on their bloody little, you know, televisions and teleprompters. Don't allow blood to be on your hands by being quiet. You have to speak up. You have to speak up. Humanity. And tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives, millions of lives depend on it.
You know, you couldn't be more correct in implicating the media, the Western media, the bankrupt state of American media due to the malicious omission of vital information, as well as the egregious distortion of what is reported, degrades even the nominal condition of democracy. You know, genuine democracy demands an objective arm of information. You know, we used to be called the fourth estate, right? But the compromised condition of American corporate-controlled media is a key factor in the depraved state of American politics and, you know, politics around the world, obviously. Just two examples from Kathleen Christensen, who we just had on the air. And you were right again in the quality of the information that she shared with us was second to none. But in her one of her latest pieces, she says, and I'll quote from her piece, she says, so far, this is with regard to the revelation from the Palestine Papers, she said, so far, there is only silence from the Obama administration, which is implicated in the documents, along with the Bush and the Clinton administrations. All right? So, you know, I'll just move on to the second part. Part two, this is a quote from Saeb Erekat, who was the Palestinian Authority's chief negotiator. This is a quote from 2009. All right, listen carefully to this. All right, this is from the Palestinian Authority's chief negotiator. Now, keep in mind, the United States is supporting the Palestinian Authority at this point. And he says, quote, we have had to kill Palestinians to establish one authority, one gun, and the rule of law. We continue to perform our obligations. We have invested time and effort and killed our own people to maintain order and the rule of law, end quote. That's who the United States is supporting. That's the likes of the works in total contradiction to the ideals that are part of the rhetoric of the American narrative. You know, the things that President Obama talked about last week in his State of the Union address, you know, is a total fraud and a total sham in light of the reality, particularly as we see what's going on around the world right now and the puppets that they manipulate around the world. Maybe it is finally time, because of the likes of WikiLeaks and Al Jazeera and some honest independent media. Obviously, we know we can't rely on the Western corporate media to report honestly and to inform objectively. So we have to turn to the likes of WikiLeaks, and we have to turn to the likes of Al Jazeera. And it's no wonder, Solomon, that both WikiLeaks and Al Jazeera are constant targets of rhetoric from the U.S. establishment. You know, particularly the media apparatus will condemn WikiLeaks and Al Jazeera and other independent news outlets and outlets from that are not Western based and don't have ties to U.S. Corporate interests. But that's the condition of the media today, and it reflects the depraved condition of politics in the United States and in the West. And, you know, you're right. It's time that, you know, we have to stand up and decide what to do. But the precondition for that, Solomon, as you know, is having the right information. And so that's why today's show was so important, and the interview was so profound, is because now that information, for those of you who are listening, that information is out there. Now you know. You're not going to hear this stuff on the corporate news. You're not going to see it on the 6 o'clock, 11 o'clock news. You're not going to hear it on NPR even to this degree.
Right.
But the information is out there, and so now we have to act accordingly. All right, we have to understand that the United States government, despite its rhetoric, is anti-democratic in its actions, not only in the United States but around the world. I mean, for the President of the United States to stand up there and talk about the United States supporting democratic aspirations of all peoples is a tragedy. I mean, it would be laughable if not for the fact that millions of people are being are being killed and displaced and go hungry and are sick because of the reality that the United States is not a democratic entity and does not support the democratic ideals of peoples near or far. All right, and the Palestinian people are one example. We're seeing people in North Africa rise up for their independence and for their self-determination. And if the United States government is serious at all in its rhetoric about supporting the self-determination and democratic aspirations of all people, then the United States government would be supporting the Palestinian people. The United States government mm-hmm. would not be making war on the Iraqi people or the Afghan people. The United States government would not be occupying Haiti and perpetrating these, you know, electoral shams and the whole perverted mess that's going on in Haiti. And the list goes on and on and on. We could talk about that. But the truth is, and you won't hear this in the corporate media, the United States government is anti-democratic in its actions and its policies, regardless of its rhetoric. Regardless of its rhetoric. You know, and if anything that we talk about, if anything sticks, I hope that that's it. You know, that the United States government is an anti-democratic organization. They call it an oligarchy, call it a plutocracy, call it a kleptocracy, call it a pigmentocracy, call it what you want, but it is not a democracy, irregardless of whether or not folks trot out to the voting booths once every 4 years or every 2 years or how often the charade takes place. We saw very clear in 2000, in 2004, that those presidential elections were complete shams. You know, they were a robbery of the election by the American ruling class. We're seeing with the Supreme Court, with the Bush versus Gore decision in late 2000 or early 2001, that elections are a total sham, and that the ruling class is united in suppressing the democratic impulse of the people. Now we see the Supreme Court did it again just last year with the Citizens United decision. That is as anti-democratic as it can get in terms of corporations being able to act as persons and had unlimited influence on federal elections. Absolutely anti-democratic, not just undemocratic, but anti-democratic. And you heard it from Kathleen Christensen, who's no left-wing radical. You know, some people might write off you and write off me, Solomon, as, you know, a couple of left-wing radicals. But Kathleen Christensen is no left-wing radical. She was a CIA analyst. She was an insider for a lot of years, for decades, inside the apparatus. And you heard it from her mouth right here on this show, talking about how the United States government is anti-democratic and does not act in the democratic interests of its people. So, you know, we can't let go of that reality, and we can't be, you know, diverted and distracted, you know, by the Super Bowl and by March Madness and, you know, all that other crap, you know. But this is people's lives are in the balance here.
Right.
People's lives are in the balance here, you know, and the future of humanity is here.
Right. Exactly. And you know, and there's others out there, folks. I mean, and you know, you read, Chalmers Johnson's series, the Blowback series, where, I mean, he basically, you know, before it actually happened, I mean, you know, it was outlining, you know, and this, he was also a CIA insider and was outlining the role that Blowback blowback plays when the U.S. government and its apparatus, go into the world and they cause havoc. They cause havoc and death and destruction, all in the interest of U.S. foreign policy. And so he was discussing the ramifications of that before even a 9/11 even occurred. You know, and this guy was a CIA, and that the CIA has a term for that and has had a term for that, for a long time, called blowback. And so, when you see, actions like that, not to justify the loss of any life that has not been a battlefield combatant that's an innocent life. But the same way that we mourn the lives of those that perished in 9/11, rightfully so, that, there was a lot of good people that lost their lives in 9/11. But in the same token, there are also a lot of good people that continue to lose their lives in Central Asia, in places like Afghanistan, and places like in Pakistan now, especially in the Waziristan region, where there are more drone attacks there now than are actually in Afghanistan, and it's expanding. The people that have lost their lives, the million plus people that have lost their lives directly and indirectly to military airstrikes in Iraq, and we know that the first 50 airstrikes when the war in Iraq started in 2003, the first 50 airstrikes missed their target. The first 50 missed their target, the first 50 missed their target. So it's the work of individuals like those. And so, get out there, if you're going to get a book or something like that, pick up a book and read, you know what I'm saying? Like Bomani says, read a book, read a motherfucking book. Pick up a book and read. Those books are out there. The Chalmers Johnson books are real quick reads. You get on Amazon right now, or go to your local community bookstore and see if they have it. If they don't have it, tell them to order it for you, and so you can purchase it from them. But John Stockwell's books, In Search of Enemies, another good book that I read some time ago, and also John Stockwell's other book, The U.S. Role in the New World Order, another good book. These folks break down what most Americans don't know, and they're not readily, well, Chalmers Johnson is deceased now, but these folks are not invited to be on the media circuit, the media buffet circuit, to talk about this, Danielle, there. So they'll have, folks, clowns like, ex-military vets like Jack Jacobs come on MSNBC and talk and basically be a mouthpiece for and we know, we saw that story break where, U.S. media was basically in bed with the military and basically having people on that were retired, generals and lieutenants that were basically given speaking and talking points from the U.S. military before they even whenever they were to go on one of these so-called news programs, and so the obfuscation and the misconception and the misleading continues to go on unabated if you continue to tune in and allow this stuff to go into your mind unchecked without any kind of counterbalance whatsoever. Lives are being lost constantly outside of U.S. borders and also inside of U.S. borders. As Peter said, as long as we continue to just allow this information to clutter, not just to clutter our minds, but to clutter our consciousness. It's about time, folks, that we all, as a society, throwing all of us in there, Peter and I into the fray. It's about time that we have a collective consciousness that is centered on humanity, that is centered on human rights and self-determination and real representative democracy. It is about time that we are a part of some kind of culture, some kind of society that is centered on those precepts, that is centered on those noble, noble virtues, not as one, not as two, not as two radical left-wing guys on a radio show, not as a community here or there, but as a society, and it starts here because so much death and destruction starts, happens, emanates from right here in the U.S. of A. So much of it starts right here. It bubbles up and it starts right here. It builds right here and then, boom, exudes itself in a most deleterious and pernicious manner into far-reaching corners of the globe, whether it is U.S., whether it is U.S. Multinationals that are wreaking havoc in places like India and places, you know, places throughout sub-Saharan Africa, or whether it's the U.S. military and war and bases, or whether it's our waste that we dump. You know, the U.S. represents 5%, which, you know, Peter and I myself are part of that population, so we represent 5% of the world's population, but we also represent 27% of the U.S. waste, of the world's waste. 27% of the world's waste comes from this 5%. Why? Because everything in the U.S. is in excess. And we also, the U.S. and its 5% population, use 25 to 26% of the world's natural resources, of the world's natural resources. And since the U.S. has consumed most of its bloody natural resources, what happens? They go to other countries, and they usurp, and they use their natural resources, all right? With our waste, we take it and we ship it off to places like India. You can go to India today, and you will find in India stacks and stacks of Dasani and Aquafina plastic water bottles that could, you know, that came from the U.S. I mean, I'm not talking about folks that were drinking Dasani and Aquafina water in India. No, the bottles, those were drank here in the U.S., and then they were shipped off there to be dealt with there, all right? And we see water, everything from aquifers and lakes in places like Siberia. Keith Harmon Snow just broke a major piece, and we hope to have him on in a couple of weeks to discuss a major story that he broke about U.S. multinational corporations like Coca-Cola that have are basically using the vast water resources and one of the world's largest freshwater lakes that happens to be in Siberia, or not in Siberia, Mongolia. This is stuff that's going on and on, and it seems, yeah, like she said, Peter, she said it was daunting. It can be kind of a downer, you know what I'm saying? But, man, damn it. I mean, what are you going to do with your life? Are you going to sit there, you know what I'm saying? Are we going to sit there and just continue to cooperate and to be a part of the system? Or are you going to be that inconvenient hero? Are you going to be that person within that system that is going to join up with like-minded individuals with that system who have collected their consciousness and set your legacy there? Your legacy is not going to be based off of how many cars or how many homes or how many pairs of sneakers that you own. Your legacy is going to be based on what you do between your birth date and your death date. And that is, and when you expire, and we all will, when we expire and make that transition to our ancestors, those that are still alive, that knew us, that knew of our work, you know, that may not have even met us personally, that knew of our work, said, hey, you know, that sister, that young lady, you know, man, she was about something. She helped this people. She started this organization. She was a part of this organization. She spoke out. This is that's what you want your legacy to be. We all got to eat. We all want to have clothes on our body. We all want to have a roof over our head. to protect us from the elements and to be able to not have to live check to check and to live in some kind of comfort. Yes, and we all I hope everyone can find that kind of comfort in their lifetime. You know, unfortunately, that's not the way it is right now. We all want that, but what do you want beyond that? What do you want beyond that? What do you want beyond that? And it sounds like sermon, you know, if you will. But you know, sometimes you know what? You know, it's good to hear the preacher. I sometimes it's good to be a part of the choir and to hear the preacher tell us things that I'm not a church going folk person, but to use a church analogy, to be a part of a part of being reinvigorated by other people's words. And I certainly don't consider myself part of it. I'm just speaking through the vessel of ancestors and doing what I'm supposed to do. Peter's doing what he's supposed to do. Just our little tiny bit. You know, it's on all of us. It's on all of us. And Peter, you being a former pastor, I don't know. You know, preach on. I mean, you being a former pastor and someone who has left the confines of Christianity and how it is used and shaped and manipulated in America, I was wondering, Peter, if you could shed some light on how Christianity has corrupted politics, or how politics has corrupted Christianity, or both, and how it has found its way into certain segments of American society that it shouldn't be, and how it continues to obfuscate and confuse and mass program individuals politically, and socially.
Well, you know, answering that question is like opening Pandora's box. And we could talk several 2-hour shows just to answer that question. And I certainly can go on about that, because the reality is that the ideology that we call Christianity, well, that's exactly what it is, ideology, all right? First and foremost, let's understand that. Let's be clear what Christianity is, or Christianism. It's an ideology, all right? Okay, it is a set of beliefs wrapped in religious language that has political motivations and political purposes, all right? That's what Christianity is. So, you know, I have rejected the entire construct, you know, because I've had a reconversion. I've had a real awakening. You know, I can see through the lie. And one of the lies that that I have to bring up tonight, particularly in the context of the show, is the lie of Christian Zionism, all right? Now, we know that, you know, in light of the interview that we had and the developments and the Israel-Palestine conflict, that Zionism takes several different forms. You know, there's political Zionism, which really doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the Jewish faith, all right? But it's about the geopolitical entity of the state of Israel, all right? And this drive to develop and sustain and perpetuate and expand, you know, the state of Israel. But Christian Zionism is a particularly odious form of support for the state of Israel under the guise of biblical faith. And what I mean particularly is this belief, this conviction that the state of Israel, the geopolitical reality of the state of Israel, is somehow a fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and that good Christians need to support the state of Israel, because that's a fulfillment of prophecy, you know, and it's the home of, you know, the Lord and the Savior and so on and so forth. And for those folks out there who are Christian or who know Christians or have heard this before, I'm begging you, please email us here at Your World News and dialogue with me about that. It's important to open your eyes to the ideology and the lie of Christian Zionism, because it's totally destructive. You know, by supporting Christian Zionism, by being a Zionist of any stripe, is to have the blood on your hands as well, is to support the quote that I just read a moment ago from the Palestinian Authority official, who said we've had to kill Palestinians and that we invest time and effort and kill our own people. That's what Zionism is about. That's the fruit of Zionism, and it's based on a lie. It's based on a perverted interpretation of a few verses, particularly in Revelation at the end of the Bible. And that misinterpretation of those small number of verses is just as perverted as when slave owners used one or two verses to justify chattel slavery. So everybody, we all have a horrible mistaste in our mouth when we think about how Christians were slave owners and that they used verses from the Bible to justify slavery. Well, that's exactly what Zionism is doing today. It's taking a few verses out of the Bible, totally misinterpreting them, misreading them, misunderstanding them, and warping them to support the state of Israel and support Zionism. And, you know, and it has absolutely nothing to do with Christianity as a faith, as a belief system. You know, it's a political perversion. And if you're listening and you know people who are Christians who might think this, confront them with it. And I would love to have this conversation with folks to help dismiss this misunderstanding. Because it's worse than just a misunderstanding. I mean, people are dying because of this. I've seen televangelists on TV, begging their people to send in donations and write letters and things, to support Israel and to support U.S. policy toward the state of Israel, all because of some religious delusion. And that's exactly what Christian Zionism is. In particular, Christianity in general is too, but Christian Zionism is a dangerous and deadly delusion that in the context of our show, I felt that I just had to bring that up because it definitely plays maybe not a big role, but certainly a role. There are enough regressive or conservative Christians in our society, Solomon, that they do have some influence. And, there's some well-moneyed churches and some very powerful and influential TV evangelists who hold these Christian Zionist beliefs and who do have the ear of the president and who do have the ear of some very powerful and influential congressmen and women and lobbyists and so forth. So, that's another narrative that we have to deconstruct. We cannot let that stand. You know, the myth and the lie of Christian Zionism is deadly and it's dangerous. And we have to deconstruct it. And I'll be happy to do that online with anyone who would take the time to email us at Your World News. So please do that. But in the broader context, Solomon, Christianity, American Christianity does support status quo. All right, it does support the state of the union. All right, to use a term that we've talked about in terms of the speech that the president made. But the state of the union is part and parcel of what Christianity is, and it's gotten to the point. And obviously, I can't go into this in any great detail tonight either, given our given the time limitations. But Christianity in America has become interdigitated to the extent that they're almost indistinguishable from one another. To a great extent, being a good Christian means being a good American. Almost to the extent that being a good American means being a good Christian. So Americanism and Christianity are so enmeshed that they form this one, like, this monolithic monster, that is Americanism. I think we would do well to do a show or part of a show talking about that, because religion is near and dear to a lot of people, and even for those of us who it's not near and dear to, whether like me it was at one point and I've kind of evolved out of that, or you've never been a religious person, we all know religious people. all know religious people, friends, family, coworkers, fellow students, what have you. And we need to have some basic understanding so that we can refute some of the arguments of Christianism, particularly from trying to make common sense out of the political landscape in this country. Because so often the two, as I said, are so enmeshed that we can't tell one from another. But I'll finish by simply saying that the Bible and the Christian faith have been so distorted over the last century or two or three, particularly since Christians landed on this continent, been so distorted that it really can no longer be called a religion, but that it is an ideology, and that it props up white supremacy, and it props up capitalism, and it props up a lot of things that are anti-democratic, that are in opposition to the rights and the freedoms of human beings, the kind of things that people claim to hold in high esteem, like justice and liberty. And I can point those out to those folks who are interested in having this dialogue, or if we have a show about that at some point in time. But, you know, the American cultural ethos is perfectly suited for Christianity to kind of be a fertilizer. Right? Christianity is kind of a fertilizer for this American ethos of materialism and individualism, and it's all a gross perversion of what's in the Bible. So that's just a few words on a large topic. But particularly keep in mind, in light of tonight's show, the evil of Christian Zionism, and how it has to be refuted and rejected. And if you know folks who are Christian Zionists or Christians who might not be aware that their support of Israel is really a betrayal of an oppressed people, the Palestinians, point that out to them, because it's one of the major problems within Christianity today, Solomon.
Right, it's just really glad you brought that up, because we're supposed to live in this nation that, for those of us that have taken the blue pill. And we're within, we understand the matrix that we're living in. These hypocrisies that we see are just, quite frankly, they are frustrating, to say the least, and infuriating. But to others who haven't taken the blue pill and they don't understand the significance of the hypocrisies that they are subjected to by their mental, mentally programming government, media, school systems, what have you. It's kind of like they're peaceful. They take it and they defend that same system that either oppresses them mentally, oppresses them physically, oppresses them monetarily, or a combination of the three in some cases. And I hope that you have ruffling people's feathers is important. But when we look at the likes of, for instance, the information you just laid out there, Peter, is all out there for everyone to see. I mean, it's happening right now. We look at, for instance, the governor of Alabama, the current governor of Alabama, the incoming governor, Robert Bailey or Bentley, I believe the clown's name is, the incoming. I mean, he's been sworn in, but the new governor of Alabama, in his inauguration speech when he was just sworn in just a couple weeks ago, he basically, to paraphrase him, basically said that he's there to serve Christians, that he is there to serve Christians. He said this, listen, folks, he didn't say this behind closed doors. He said this out in the open. He said that he is here to serve Christians.
Non-Christians are not his brothers and sisters.
Non-Christians are not his brothers and sisters. You can look it up. Just Google it. You know, I don't just Google it, folks. I mean, we're online right now. We're all technologically savvy enough to. His name is just go to Google and just Google Alabama Governor Robert Bentley. Just Google that, and, you know, and you'll find a slew of articles talking about it. And you know, that's just evidence out there. But he was widely supported within his state because of those comments. Widely supported. All right. And even more so supported behind closed doors. I'm certain. Even more so supported behind closed doors by congressmen and congresswomen and senators that are in Capitol Hill right now. Capitol Hill right now probably soliciting some prostitute. you know the same that are in some bathroom stall at the airport like Larry Craig was and oops I didn't know that was I just do that so. Some of the biggest hypocrites, some of the folks that we'll see at the C Street House and so forth. But, it goes on. So Peter was right on spot, and maybe that's the topic of a future show. You know, we have, 3.5 minutes left. But, in closing, folks, open your eyes. Like Peter said, email us, Your World News. YourWorldNews2010@gmail.com. That's YourWorldNews2010@gmail.com. You can email Peter or myself. We'll both get the email. So if your email is addressed to the former pastor, gone rogue, not gone rogue like that dingbat. Mental midget from Alaska, Sarah Palin, not gone rogue like her, but gone rogue in a much different way, in a much more progressive way. You want to email Peter Fowler, you can reach both of us at that email. And we want to thank you. I want to close with a song that I think will is quite suiting for what we talked about today. It's quite suiting. Peter and I will see you next time on Your World News, which will be within the next week. Stay tuned. Become a friend on our Blog Talk site. I'm not on Facebook, and I don't see myself going on Facebook anytime soon. And maybe that's another thing we'll talk. Facebook was partly started by some venture capital money that came from some high-ranking folks in the CIA that did not go rogue, did not make an about-face like Charles Johnson or Stockwell or Kathy Christensen, but Facebook just another apparatus to monitor you or monitor us. I mean, I don't need another tool like that. But if you want to be a friend on Your World News, simply for the fact that it will update you every time we have a new show, not to be monitored, but just to get on there and it will tell you every time we have a new show, or you can just email us and get on our listserv. But it is Your World News, and this is. Wise Intelligent. This is Globe Holders. Until next time, this is Solo and Peter. We're out.
In 1950, the AIDS virus was fed to nearly 300,000 black youth in Africa in the form of an oral polio vaccine by Dr. Hilary Kaprowski, who is currently the director of biovirology at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. Today, a child dies every minute of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. In the U.S., African Americans represent 49% of all new AIDS cases. The globe holders, the population controllers, the AIDS makers, dark nation depopulators, the conscious trainers, American Nazi bankers, the tower bombers, right-wing Al-Qaeda sponsors, Hitler's accomplice, 9/11 mission accomplished, free your conscience, in ghettos they kill the prophets, the juggernauts, the alphabet cops, the CIA, CFBI, the coca crops, imported to local blocks, the 5 years for the black to the month that the cracker got, a powder pot, compared to a gram of rock, got blacks at 50% of the prison pop, the whacking huts, the correction corporations, the international plan. Parenthood Federation, the forced abortion, forced sterilizations, the sons of Satan, Operation Depopulation. From 1924 to 1976, 32 states in the U.S. utilized eugenics programs to depopulate the country of so-called weak breeds. enemies who were downbreeding the American population. Some 65,000 black youth from public school districts throughout the country were given a biased IQ test. All who failed the test were sterilized against their or their parents' will. The diamond dealers, them choppers and baby killers, the oil drillers, black nation resource killers, the truth concealers, suppression of true guerrillas, Patrice Lumumba, Nkrumah, Lauren Kabila, the people traitors, poor population enslavers, the black slash brown slash yellow baby cremators, the black slash brown slash yellow unity haters, the red slash white slash blue liberty waivers, eugenicists, world imperialists, evolutionists, black womb pollutionists, the euthanizers, third world birth sterilizers, Nazi sympathizers, finances and arms suppliers, the nuke igniters, the World Health Organizers, the virus writers, smallpox, Ebola slices, the throne of surfers, the worst death deservers, the devil worship, more power for every murder. A 1996 expose by the San Jose Mercury News documented CIA involvement in a Nicaraguan drug ring which poured thousands of kilos of cocaine into Los Angeles African-American neighborhoods in the 1980s. Drug boss Danilo Blandon, now an informant for the DEA, acknowledged under oath the drugs for weapons deals with the CIA-sponsored Contras. The Club of Rome, World Bank, the Skull and Bones, Allah Hamdu Allah engraved in the Pope's throne, the camouflage, the right versus left mirage, Bush and Kerry got naked to pledge in the same lodge, the Reagan years, the luminous presidents. Ever since, they've been facing the obelisk, the Kabbalist. Harry Potter is not a myth. This ain't on radio, but this that shit. The war on drugs has been a war on poor people, particularly poor urban African American men and women. It's well documented that police enforcement of the new harsh drug laws have been focused on low-level dealers in communities of color. Arrests of African Americans have been about 5 times higher than arrests of whites, although whites and African Americans use drugs at about the same rate. African Americans have been imprisoned in numbers even more disproportionate than their relative arrest rates. It is estimated that in 1994, on any given day, one out of every 128 U.S. adults was incarcerated, while one out of every 17 African American adult males was incarcerated. The differential in sentencing for powder and crack cocaine is one glaring example of institutionalized racism. About 90% of crack arrests are of African Americans, while 75% of powder cocaine arrests are of whites. Under federal law, it takes only 5 grams of crack cocaine to trigger a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence, but it takes 500 grams of powder cocaine, 100 times as much, to trigger the same sentence for a white boy.